Nuclear history. It's one thing to look back on a nuclear accident and one's proximity to it from a distance of years, if not decades, shrug your shoulders and continue to bury it in your mind. Trust me, I know, I've been there. But going back to that place of proximity and terror shows how fresh it remains, how present, and that you are never rid of it. That's why a new film can be so important. A documentary that covers the subject material in depth. Among the content, when one's job is to cover the news, but the news may be deadly to your own health and future, there's a feeling of panic, futility, fear, and mortality that pops up and never leaves your heart or soul. So when the nuclear industry, government agencies, elected officials, and others try to convince you that nothing important happened at the nuclear meltdown at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania in 1979, you can't help but bring to mind that woman who was 22 years old, a previously untried radio news reporter at the time who was based in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and she tells you,
when Governor Thornburgh ordered the evacuation of pregnant women and preschool-aged children, as a 22-year-old, I was absolutely petrified. The newsmen in the Capitol newsroom were immediately evacuating their families. And I am there standing there thinking, what the heck am I doing here? I have no idea what exposure is happening to me and will I ever be able to have children?
Well, when you hear a personal truth about a nuclear incident that still has overwhelming power after more than 40 years, and then you get to watch a brand new documentary film that presents the truth and so much more about the nuclear meltdown at Three Mile Island and its ongoing aftermath, you begin to recognize just how tenuous an illusion is that thing that others call nuclear safety. But you are experiencing as an ultimate nuclear threat, and that threat is smack dab in the middle of your neighborhood, if not your own backyard. That's when you realize that this, here, right now, where you are at, is ground zero for that deadly nightmare of a seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. And now, so can you. This week, we celebrate the world premiere of a documentary by Heidi Huttner, Radioactive, The Women of Three Mile Island. The premiere took place just last Sunday, December 4th, 2022, in New York City. We have interviews with participants in the film, one of the mothers featured in it, a novice local radio journalist who was sent to cover some not-yet-defined little problem down at the local N plant, those who worked on the film, and many others. It's a You Are There experience of the event, which took place at the Dances with Films Film Festival in New York. We also celebrate the announcement that is just in, that because of my work on Nuclear Hot Seat, I have just been awarded the 2022 Nuclear Free Future Award for Education. This is an international award. I'm honored to be given it, and more on this will be coming up. We will also have nuclear news from around the world. Linda Pence-Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, Numbnuts of the Week for Outstanding Nuclear Boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than has been included in the latest set of subpoenas issued by the Department of Justice. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, December 6, 2022, And here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. In Ukraine, Petro Khotin, the president of the national nuclear energy company Energoatom, has urged the Ukrainians still working at the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant not to sign any documents with the Russians and Rosatom, the Russian state corporation that runs all nuclear power plants in that country. Khotin also announced that the deputy chief engineer at Zaporizhia, Yuri Chernichuk, has betrayed Ukraine and collaborated with the Russian occupiers. Instead of making every effort to liberate the plant as soon as possible, instead, Chernichuk decided to help the Russian occupiers legalize the criminal seizure of Zaporizhia and now incites other nuclear workers to do the same. Chernichuk has been fired from Energoatom, the Ukrainian nuclear power company, and Khotin said that he would, quote, sooner or later be held responsible for everything before the law and before people. The Russian government also claimed in late October that Ukraine was preparing to use a dirty bomb and blame it on Russia. But there has never been any evidence for this claim. It has been widely dismissed and suspected of being gaslighting to make Ukraine look bad and weaken its international support, preparation for a false flag operation in which Russia would use a dirty bomb and blame it on Ukraine, or as a pretext for Russia to use nuclear weapons. In truth, because of the radiation levels in the spent fuel ponds, every nuclear reactor on the face of the planet is, in itself, a potential dirty bomb. And all it would take is one explosive device to blow up a spent fuel pool, and we would be facing the equivalent of Chernobyl wherever this might happen. In a recent report by Australian journalist Charles McFedrin, based on analysis of information from captured Russian documents, plans existed from the start of the war to use Ukrainian nuclear plants to blackmail Europe into submission with the threat of nuclear contamination, nuclear blackmail as a weapon of war. In North Carolina, more than 33,000 homes and businesses remain without power after two electrical substations were damaged by gunfire in what authorities are calling an intentional attack. The attack comes amid growing concerns from federal officials about the vulnerability of the nation's power grid to terrorism and the security of key pieces of equipment. Authorities said that whoever is responsible, quote, knew exactly what they were doing to cause the damage and cause the outage that they did. Which raises the question, what about nuclear facilities that are reliant on the grid for their own energy needs? Case in point, Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico, which currently plans to build a power line that will increase its dependence upon a single substation linking it to the grid. This could lead to the type of attack that so crippled the nuclear reactors at Zaporizhia in Ukraine, and also these two substations in North Carolina. And it raises the question of why LANL, Los Alamos National Laboratory, did not choose a decentralized option of its own generation of renewable energy, be it wind, solar, geothermal, or a combination of all of the above. In southeast Utah, residents of the Ute Mountain Ute tribe protest the last active uranium mill in the country, the White Mesa Mill, operated by Energy Fuels. During the Cold War, the U.S. government bankrolled the industry and mining companies, which rushed to profit by building more than 50 mills and processing sites to refine uranium more. But the government did not have a plan for the toxic byproducts of this nuclear assembly line, and so more than 250 million tons of toxic and radioactive debris is scattered into nearby communities, streams, and aquifers. And in what is so usually the case, it is the Native American tribal people who are paying closest attention, raising the hue and cry, and hoping that the rest of us hear and support them. Reports of the week's nuclear problems, as sent to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and compiled by Ed Lyman of the Union of Concerned Scientists. More security violations have been found at the Farley nuclear plant in Alabama. Farley is already in trouble with the regulator for a mysterious security incident that occurred last September. Also in Alabama, at Browns Ferry Unit 3, a through-wall leak in the residual heat removal system, constituting a serious degradation of one of the principal safety barriers, was discovered. at the Urenco USA Uranium Enrichment Facility in New Mexico, a pump on a tank catastrophically failed and leaked 170 liters of radioactive water, with about 10 liters spilling directly onto the floor of the room. At the Turkey Point nuclear plant in Florida, two fire protection violations were discovered when a worker broke a fire pump during a test, and the test interval for a remote control panel switch was improperly increased from 18 to 72 months. Three cybersecurity violations were found at the Prairie Island nuclear plant in Minnesota, and in Louisiana at the Waterford site, there were some screws loose or missing, raising questions about seismic resistance of the emergency feed water pumps. Three violations resulted. We'll have links up to larger articles on the website, including one on how U.S. renewable energy will surge past coal and nuclear by the year's end. Over to Japan, where...
Nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, none that's out of week.
When the nuclear industry wants to get its own way, no matter what the facts of the matter show, well, it's time to play the nuclear numbers game. In Japan, the number 3 unit at the Mahama Nuclear Power Plant in Fukui Prefecture is the first reactor in Japan to operate beyond the 40-year service period. Japan is now considering how to keep some nuclear reactors operating beyond a current 60-year limit, despite the fact that the engineers who designed and built these nuclear behemoths in the first place said, you know, after 40 years, it's just not safe to operate them, so once you get to 40, shut them down. Yeah, try arguing that when there's a profit motive in mind. So how is Japan planning to massage the numbers? Officials are studying a plan that would exclude periods of time when reactors were offline from an existing limit on their lifespan. Reactors are often halted for years to allow the nation's nuclear watchdog to perform inspections or as the result of legal challenges. Now, despite experiencing the worst atomic meltdown disaster to ever hit planet Earth, Japan is buckling to intense pressure from the nuclear industry to shift back in favor of nuclear power and cook the books so it looks like the whole thing is A-OK. Pro-nuclear Prime Minister Fumio Kishida said the government will explore developing and constructing new reactors, as it also aims to restart 7 more idled reactors and run them for as long as he possibly can. After Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and Fukushima, you'd think this was a country that just might be averse to nuclear. And if you talk to the citizens, you'll find out that the majority of them are. But that won't stop the government, that won't stop the industry, and that is why, Prime Minister Kishida, and your nuclear numbers crunchers, you are this week's...
Nuclear hot seat, none that's out of week.
At Fukushima, the Concrete Support Foundation for a reactor whose core melted down during the nuclear power plant triple meltdown disaster in 2011 has deteriorated so much that reinforcing bars, or rebar, is now exposed. Masao Uchibori, governor of Fukushima Prefecture, has expressed concerns about the earthquake resistance of this pedestal for the number one reactor at the crippled plant. It now forms a cylindrical pedestal, the wall of which is 1.2 meters or 4 feet thick and 6 meters or 19.6 feet in diameter. While part of the pedestal was inspected last May, it was only done from the outside, and the pedestal's inside integrity or lack thereof remains a mystery. A former engineer who is now an advisor to the Fukushima prefectural government on nuclear safety issues said, "It is important to first inspect the pedestal from the inside." You think? A petition with over 140,000 signatures demanding the withdrawal of the nuclear power promotion measures being considered by the Kishida administration has been submitted to the government. Points opposed included extension of the operating period of nuclear power plants, which is stipulated to be 40 years in principle and 60 years in maximum, and the reconstruction and replacement of nuclear power plants that have been scheduled to be decommissioned. Thus far, there has been no official response from the government. And activists and academics continue to join forces to fight plans by Japan to start dumping nuclear wastewater from the damaged Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant into the Pacific Ocean. At least 800,000 tons of tritium-contaminated radioactive wastewater is scheduled to be dumped in the ocean by Japan over the next 30 years, starting as of early 2023. Joey Tao, Pacific Network on Globalization Deputy Coordinator, stated, "The ocean is not stagnant, and Pacific Islands will be at the forefront of disposal." Pacific anti-nuclear activists, a Hiroshima bomb survivor, and academics voiced their opposition at the Nuclear Connections Across Oceania Conference in Dunedin at the end of November. Computer modeling suggests that the radioactive waste would travel to Korea, China, and then the Federated States of Micronesia and Palau. Duncan Curry, an international law expert, told the conference, "Japan has other options, like storing the waste on land, which is costly, but countries need to take a stand now. Very simply, any country, any Pacific country, Korea, China, could take a case against Japan in the International Tribunal of Law of the Sea, demanding an injunction or what are called provisional measures in international law to be exercised." Now here's Linda Pence Gunter with this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
I've been searching for the equivalent word in French for chutzpah. So far, I haven't found one, but it was either chutzpah or just plain stupidity that caused French President Emmanuel Macron to pitch a French nuclear renaissance during his state visit to Washington, D.C. last week. Apparently, he completely missed, or conveniently forgot, the last time France tried to stage a nuclear renaissance in the US back in 2007. While it didn't exactly flop on opening night, 7 French EPR reactors were originally mooted and 4 submitted license applications, it closed early with precisely 0 built. But here was Macron in Washington with his latest nuclear mise-en-scene, complete with an atomic entourage that included representatives from the state nuclear regulator, cabinet ministers, and the bankrupt French nuclear power industry. Never mind that the backdrop to Macron's nuclear promotional tour is the most breathtaking pile of wreckage imaginable. Sacre bleu, if you wanted to paint a picture of a complete industrial fiasco, you need only look at today's French nuclear power industry. The French nuclear sector is arguably at its nadir, with half of the country's 56 reactor fleets still offline, a crisis that has persisted for months. Some went down due to summer heat waves or routine maintenance outages, but many of them are closed for safety reasons after the discovery of severe corrosion in piping. Now, as winter sets in, there are warnings of power outages. So much for reliable nuclear power. As Matthew Dalton wrote in the Wall Street Journal in October, France's vaunted nuclear fleet has been about as effective as the Maginot Line, the French fortifications that did little to stop the German invasion during World War II. Last February, just before the elections that saw him retain his throne in the presidential palace, Macron announced the country would go full radioactive steam ahead with 6 to 14 new EPR2 reactors. Yes, the new improved EPR. France would also extend the operating licenses of the entire current reactor fleet, initiate projects for small modular reactors, and resume exploration of so-called Generation 4, read fast, or breeder reactors. Macron even bragged that France would build 6 of the new EPR2 reactors on 3 existing sites, with a first start-up date around 2035 and at an estimated cost of $52 billion. Never mind, he still hasn't delivered the EPR being built on French soil at Flamanville in Normandy. That project is now 12 years behind schedule, with 2023 the latest and likely still optimistic projected start-up date. The original $3.7 billion budget has ballooned to at least $21.5 billion and climbing for one reactor. Whatever Macron's smoking, they're not Gauloises. We could talk about the other EPR flagship, Olkiluoto 3 in Finland, now running 12 years late and with costs tripled. After a brief test run, it was abruptly shut down in April and again in August and September due to problems with feed water pumps and steam turbine failures. In China, the only place the EPR is actually operating, Taishan Unit 1 had to be shut down in July 2021 due to damaged fuel rods and remained disconnected from the grid for a year. It was just predicted that the two EPRs being built in England at Hinkley C are likely delayed until 2036, with costs soaring there to well beyond $31 billion. The actual Renaissance was an extraordinary flowering of art, music and culture that left a permanent legacy of dazzling genius. Macron's nuclear Renaissance is about as serious as a Feydeau farce, the kind provoked by a carnival barker or peddled by a snake oil salesman. Last year, Macron was forced to order a nationwide lockdown of so-called free-range poultry in France due to the spread of bird flu across Europe. Right now, he is looking very much like le dindon de la farce. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
We'll have this week's special feature in just a moment. But first, yeah, great news. I have just learned that I have received the 2022 Nuclear Free Future Award for Education. It's an international award, and the magnitude of it just stuns me to gratitude. The news is so fresh, details are going to have to wait until next week because I haven't gotten all of them yet, just the announcement. But this is the second piece of important information you need to know regarding the show. The other is that we have just received federal approval as a 501c3 not-for-profit organization. That means when you donate to the show, it is now tax deductible. The only thing that makes this show possible is donations, your donations. We're always grateful for whatever you can do, and now we can offer you a tax deduction to go along with our gratitude. As we move into the holiday season, know that we need your year-end help more than ever. We make it easy to donate and support the show so you can continue to receive more honest nuclear information than you'll ever get from mainstream media. And it's a tax write-off. So help keep Nuclear Hot Seat up and running. Make a donation of any size. It's easy. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com. Look for the red button. You can make it a one-time donation of any size or sustain us with a recurring donation. It can be as little as $5 a month. Here in the U.S., that's the price of a cup of coffee. So buy us a cup of coffee or more. Isn't Nuclear Hot Seat worth the equivalent of a cup of coffee? So help us out this month, and if you can, every month, so that we can keep providing you with the most reliable nuclear information from the longest-running program of this type in the world. And now an acknowledged part of our nuclear-free future. NuclearHotSeat.com, red button, and know that whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's special feature. It's hard to get the full picture of what nuclear is and what it does across to the general public. Disconnected news stories, nuclear industry full press spin, ADHD news cycles, and the public's general lack of memory obscures the horrible truth about what happens when a nuclear reactor goes off the rails. Thus, it is cause for celebration when a full-length documentary appears that tells the nuclear story clearly, completely, with human focus and all the compelling arguments and footnotes in place. That's the case with the new film, Radioactive, The Women of Three Mile Island. Produced and directed by eco-feminism professor-turned-visual journalist Heidi Huttner, the film uses four mothers who lived through and next to Three Mile Island as the focus for this crucial film. TMI is the worst nuclear accident in U.S. history, so far, and has been buried under decades of nuclear industry spin-speak. Now, at last, the truth can come out, and in a word, it's brilliant. As described in the film's materials, four original concerned mothers, a two-woman legal team, and a reporter break open years of corporate silencing and nuclear industry doublespeak and tell their stories about the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant accident, the worst commercial nuclear reactor meltdown in U.S. history. Though this disaster took place in 1979, the life and death implications continue in the spiritual, physical, and political DNA of the community, its residents, and their descendants. Radioactive had its world premiere at the Dances with Films Festival in New York City last Sunday, December 4. While I was unable to attend, I did avail myself of help in capturing some of the excitement of the event. First, I checked in with Priscilla Starr. She is founder of the Coalition Against Nukes and was instrumental in producing the first post-Fukushima national protest against nuclear, which took place in Washington, D.C. in March of 2012.
Priscilla, what motivated you to come to New York City to see the film Radioactive, The Women of Three Mile Island, and where did you come from?
It took 2 hours by bus. I came in from Sag Harbor. I'm motivated to see a film that a good friend has put out for mainstream watching, which hopefully it will be. I was motivated to see the work of someone I consider not to be a fanatic, but to be a realist, and I highly respect her. So I wanted to see for myself what she's been working on for the last so many years. I think it's about 5 years.
I think it's actually probably longer than that. Hopefully I'll be able to talk with Heidi before too long and get an interview for the show where she'll explain all of those details for us. But for you, coming from 2 hours of travel, getting to the theater, walking in, what was it like? What was the audience like? What was the energy like?
It was exciting, and there were a lot of people that were probably like coming in just to do, you know, see a film festival such as this, and they're interested to see something that was of historic value. So it wasn't just like anti-nukers that I was identifying in the audience. Before we sat down, we could see, you know, basically the look of the audience, the age group, which was very mixed. So there were quite a lot of young people there, which was exciting. that was the best part, I think, to see that it wasn't just the choir. It was exciting to see the people that I knew had worked on the film and to see them in person, because I've only seen their pictures on social media and been communicating with them on Facebook. So it was exciting to see the people she collaborated with. It was exciting to meet the people that were in the film, some of them. The moms. That was very exciting to meet them afterwards. So, you know, to be with those people who were filmed, the subjects of the film after everything occurred, was humbling. That was powerful in itself.
So you've come down to New York City. You're in an audience. You're watching this film. What was it like taking the ride, taking the journey that the film created for you?
It was very exciting to see her use historical footage of what we saw on TV. She weaved that through her interviews with the moms. It was brilliant how she brought in Jane Fonda. Jane Fonda even discussing her feelings about having done the China Syndrome. And then 12 days later, this accident occurs. So it's very real, sort of like a punch in the face. You know, you cannot escape how it feels. It really, you know, happens. So it wasn't the China Syndrome what happened at Three Mile Island, but it was certainly one of the worst accidents in the world that ever happened from a nuclear power plant. So it was very realistic because you have the women, the moms, being interviewed. Heidi is in their homes. And when you actually see the cooling towers from one of the homes, it's, you know, that's very scary. No, it's very real when you see those towers so close outside a window. That's frightening.
Priscilla Starr. We'll hear more from her shortly. On-site interviews at the theater were conducted by longtime Nuclear Hot Seat listener and supporter Joe DeMare. He is the host and producer of For a Green Future, a radio program that covers a wide range of environmental and ecological issues. It's broadcast in Toledo and Columbus, Ohio, and then posted as a podcast and on a YouTube channel. Joe also organizes an annual event remembering the Fukushima nuclear disaster called Unplug Nuclear Power, which is a 24-hour boycott of grid-supplied electricity every March 11. So it was an honor to have him step forward to help us out. His first interview for Nuclear Hot Seat was with a reporter who was on the job when the Three Mile Island meltdown began.
My name is Michelle Lefevre Quinn,
and I was part of the news team that broke the story to the world about the Three Mile Island nuclear accident.
Right. You had some pretty intense footage in there in terms of your experience at the time.
It was a very frightening experience. I was a young reporter just out of college. It was my first job in radio. I didn't know much about nuclear power at all. In fact, I knew that there was a plant, Three Mile Island, and I was aware of them because as the new reporter, I would write the public service announcements for the radio station, and I would get these news releases from Three Mile Island Alert, which was the anti-nuclear power group. So that's what I knew about Three Mile Island. That was about it, you know.
Right.
And then the day of the accident, we came in. We did the morning news. I co-anchored the morning news with Mike Pintek, and the day started just like any other day. The first thing I would do when I come in at 6 in the morning would be to call the various counties to see if there were any incidences overnight or occurring. And at that time, nothing happened, even though the accident we now know had occurred a little after 4 in the morning. But at 6 o'clock, they didn't know anything. It was about 8 o'clock in the morning when our traffic reporter, Captain Dave, contacted us on the CB and said, I understand there's fire trucks going to Three Mile Island, and you may want to investigate it. And he also said to Mike, he said, and by the way, there's no steam coming out at the towers. And Mike said, I know, Unit 1 is shut down for daily maintenance or whatever it is that they usually do. And when he said there was no steam coming out of either of the towers, that's when Mike knew. He knew enough about nuclear power that something was wrong. Back in those days, we used to have to get 2 verifications before we ever reported anything.
Mm-hmm.
So he directed me to right away call Dauphin County Emergency Preparedness. And while I was doing that, he had the phone book out and was calling calling Three Mile Island. I confirmed from Dauphin County Preparedness that yes, indeed, fire engines were dispatched to Three Mile Island. He, meanwhile, got the operator at Three Mile Island, and she was so flustered, she patched him into the control room. So he was speaking directly to control room operators who said, we have a problem, I can't talk. You need to call Metropolitan Edison Company in Reading, Pennsylvania, which was the operators of the plant. Mike called right away, talked to a gentleman by the name of Blaine Fabian, who did verify that there had been an incident at Three Mile Island, but no, there was no danger to the public. So that's what he reported at 8:25, and that's when the public first learned that anything had happened.
Right. And do you think the movie did a good job of catching the
yes.
emotions at the time?
Oh, it definitely did. The four women are just amazing, amazing women for sticking to it, trying to get the truth. I teared up a number of times. And as a young reporter at that time, I was petrified. It was Friday when everything went crazy. My boss sent me up to the state capitol to monitor what the government was doing. And when Governor Thornburgh ordered the evacuation of pregnant women and preschool-aged children, as a 22-year-old, I was absolutely petrified. The newsmen in the Capitol newsroom were immediately evacuating their families. And I am there standing there thinking, what the heck am I doing here? I have no idea what exposure is happening to me and will I ever be able to have children. Mike Pintek, my boss, came to relieve me about 7 o'clock that evening. And I looked at him and I said, Mike, what should I do? And he told me years later he had never seen such fear in anyone's eyes. And that was when I went back to my apartment in Hershey. I left Saturday morning and went to Philadelphia because I just couldn't handle it. It was just so frightening and scary. I was saying goodbye to my friends. My friends were leaving to New Jersey. We didn't know whether we'd ever see each other again. But when I got home, I had time to think. By Sunday, President Carter had shown up, and I realized I couldn't, if I wanted to be a reporter, I had to go back, and I had to do my job, and I had wanted to be a reporter. So I got in the car, showed up at work Monday morning, and Mike told me, he said, I had no idea whether you were going to show up or not. He said, I didn't care. But he did advise me to pack a bag. And so for a month, I drove around with my bags packed with clothes from all four seasons. Because if you're evacuated, you might never come back again.
Right. How many stars would you give the movie?
Five stars. It's emotional. I think especially for people who lived the experience, it is extremely emotional to go back over it. And that's why I have always vowed that I never want to be near a nuclear power plant. I don't want them operating because of what it did to all the people in the community. I moved away from the area in 1985. Fortunately, I was pregnant, and it was before they started Unit 1. I don't know if I could have handled that if I was there when they restarted Unit 1. But I came back about 6 years ago, and when I started seeing the incidences of cancer, I said, something's going on. So I am so thrilled that Heidi spent the time to talk to so many people and get the scientific data to back her up. I urge everyone to see this movie.
Joseph DeMare interviewing Michelle Lefevre Quinn. Next, Joe talked with an audience member.
Hi, my name is Anna Zara Aldrich.
Hi, I'm interviewing this for a nuclear hot seat, which I might have heard of that one. Libby Hall, Libby. What did you think of the film?
I thought it was an excellent film. I think it told the stories very powerfully, and these stories are critical to be telling.
Mm-hmm. And was it what you expected when you went in?
Yeah, I think it was what I expected. My understanding of the film was that I was going to be showcasing these women's stories and showcasing the truth that has been covered up until now, and I think it did a really great job of communicating that.
Mm-hmm. It uncovered the factual truth, but it also kind of uncovered the sort of the human dimension, wouldn't you say? Oh. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the moments that really stood out to me was at the end when one of the women said she didn't want to see the map because it was something she knew to be true even without that scientific map showing where the cloud was. And I think that was a really powerful dimension as well, as sort of the scientific, but as well the emotional truth and the lived experience.
So would you suggest other people see this film?
Absolutely. I would suggest that anyone see this film. I think that it's beautiful and powerful and immaculately done.
Priscilla Starr talked about the work that producer and director Heidi Huttner did on the film.
She did a brilliant job having like the feeling of what happened in history, but contested by the moms, the utility company, the mayor. Everybody's giving a different message. Don't worry, there is no danger, as we know that is what the NRC will always say. There is no danger. But there was an evacuation. People were running scared in the streets, getting in cars, not knowing what to do. In the film, one of the moms recounts how her relatives came home with one of them, a paper bag over her head with just slits for her eyes and her nose, as I recall, something close to that, because someone said if you put a paper bag over your head, you will not have the radiation affect you.
Wow.
Yes, right? That's just...
talk about the
crazy,
willful and the programmed ignorance as to what radiation is, what it does, and that we could be desperate enough to put a paper bag over our heads and think it's not going to... there's not going to be any harm.
We'll check back with Priscilla one more time. Joseph DeMare was fortunate in snagging one of the mothers who was featured in the film for this brief interview.
My name's Joyce Karate, and I live near Three Mile Island, where the accident happened in 1979. And I, along with four other women, created a group called Concerned Mothers and Women to fight the closing of the plant, which happened, but we still have to fight for cleanup. The island still has an immense amount of nuclear waste there. So,
now, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that the four of you were basically stars of this movie. how does that feel?
I'm not interested in stardom. I'm interested in getting the information out for people to be aware, to make wise decisions, to, you know, empower the individual. I think all too often we give our power away. Mm-hmm. We're powerful people. We just forget we are.
Right. And Heidi kind of touched on that in the Q&A afterwards, she mentioned how a lot of young people today never even heard of Three Mile Island, don't know anything about the dangers of nuclear power.
Yeah. I think that's probably somewhat generational, and I think things affect you when they're in your own backyard, which this was for me. I think it's like global warming and hunger. We all are concerned, but what do we really do? Mm-hmm. So we have to become more aware and more appreciative of each other. I thought that was what the pandemic taught us, mm-hmm. that really to appreciate each other.
Yeah.
All too often we don't, when things terribly go wrong, that we really need each other.
Right. So are you happy with the movie, the way it turned out?
I thought it was lovely. And I salute Heidi for what she did.
Yeah. All right. Well, anything you'd like to add?
Never give up.
Never give up.
Never give up.
All right.
Joe also had a chance to speak with someone who worked on the tech of the film. And just because one is involved on the production side does not mean that they were not impacted by the information that they were working on.
My name is Roger Grange. I actually worked on the film, just on some of the photography and the drone shots. I thought it turned out great. I mean, it's very powerful, has a message that is very clear, that people can't really take for granted things that they're told, and people have to stay on top of the government and corporations to make sure that things are done properly.
So as somebody who worked on the movie, what did you think about the audience reaction?
I was surprised. It was quite active. Mm-hmm. Participation during the movie. There were quite a number of moments of applause and various reactions that normally in a film festival screening, people are pretty quiet until the end.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, no, there were a lot of cheers and a few boos there, but
really,
I think it was all at the appropriate moments.
Oh yeah, so, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. What would you say to people who are considering seeing this film? Should they go see it? And if so, why?
Well, anybody who's interested in the history of both nuclear power and anybody who's interested in social justice issues and activism within government corporate malfeasance will definitely benefit from seeing the film.
Then Joe managed to talk with one more audience member.
David Rimby.
Hey, and what did you think of the film?
I thought it was very illuminating, mm-hmm. very interesting. I grew up about 90 miles from there.
Oh, did you?
Yes.
Yeah. Upwind?
Suburbs of Philadelphia.
Upwind or downwind?
Downwind.
Downwind. And what surprised you in this film? What didn't you know before?
What surprised me is how much information they knew, but they didn't release to the public.
Yeah.
In my opinion, because I remember in my teen years hearing about it, but then you didn't hear about it.
Right.
And being in the Philadelphia suburban market, you think it would knew more than it actually was going on.
Yeah, that was really, I think for a lot of people, the Three Mile Island is where you really, one of the first times in their lives, found out just how much the government was willing to lie to you.
Yeah, and yes, and how much they were in bed with the corporation.
Right. So this movie sort of captured not just the factual truth, but the emotional truth.
I would agree with that.
Yeah. Do you think that was an effective way to tell the story?
I think so. Mm-hmm. Because there really hasn't been much other information released from government agencies or scientists at this point. So I don't know what other way you could tell the story.
That's true. The studies haven't been done. What rank would you give this out of 5 stars?
I give it 5. I thought it was very powerful.
All right.
Yeah.
Would there be anything you want to add about it? Anything that caught your attention?
I think people should really actually see the movie. I think I'll learn a lot.
Yeah.
And there's a lot more questions to ask that need answers.
Yes, indeed there are. Finally, we checked in once more with Priscilla Starr on what she found most powerful about the film.
In watching the film, what did you find most powerful, most shocking about the information that you were receiving?
Maybe because I'm already informed that there is danger, it was not something that I was just seeing for the first time. So I've already been programmed to feel that what is most powerful has become familiar, that there is danger. So I don't mean to step away from the question, but it seems like I'm already conditioned to know that that which is most powerful for enlightening the mainstream public has become familiar to people in the anti-nuclear movement to believe it is very dangerous. Actually, the most powerful moment for me in watching this film were the women at the end getting together, and Heidi is focusing on them taking these steps towards the circle at the end. And it's like a healing circle that they do. But it felt very powerful that they're all walking back to that circle in the end. And I told her this. I was most moved by that. It was like rooted very down home. You know, she had a good image. Almost that was the last scene of them getting together again by the same place they got together. I guess it's the first year after and every year since, to commemorate at that moment in time, close to 4 a.m., what happened. You know, that was the most powerful part of it for me, besides seeing the cooling towers outside of a window.
When I was at Three Mile Island for the 40th anniversary, I was also there at the 4 a.m. ceremony. I don't know if that's the one that Heidi filmed or not. I don't believe so. But while I was there and realizing how close the odometer was to sweeping around and giving you that, you know, that even number with all the zeros on going, yeah, and now we're going to go into another year, that I broke down sobbing. I could not stop because it was like all the sadness, all the alienation, all the loss, all the fear, everything was concentrated, and I was safe in an environment with others who understood, who had been through it themselves in their own way. And I no longer had to carry the burden of taking care of other people's feelings by not mentioning something that was upsetting. We were all upset, and we were all there to be with each other. And so I can understand how in showing that at the end of the film, that could be tremendously impactful on you, because having lived it, it was tremendously impactful for me.
The scene of their foot after foot after foot after foot, like, you know, each set of feet for each mom walking back, that's all you see. And it was just a journey, you know, they're on a journey and they haven't stopped. It was powerful. I understood, because you start that journey and you have to keep going with it. And they're still standing. And they're wonderful. They're just wonderful for having worked with her. And I didn't meet all of them, but it was wonderful to see that at the end, because she knew just how to begin to end her film. So, you know, there's always a beginning, a middle, and an end. So as far as a film is concerned, you want that end to come at the right time. So that was a great scene before, you know, the last few captions on the film.
What was the audience response like?
A lot of times people would clap to approve of the mom saying, you know, sorry, we're not buying it, and you're messing with our families. A lot of applause. But everybody was right there with them, understanding and feeling what they felt, and they didn't have to even come up with big words or, you know, fancy slogans or talk radio nuclei. They knew how they felt, that they had been lied to and misled, and no real communication was coming from the higher ups and the elected officials. So everyone was applauding with empathy for them.
I heard it got a standing ovation.
It did. I stood. Everybody did stand. It was great. It was great.
So what do you think and what do you hope will be the impact of this film?
Well, I hope that it's not just going to be at film festivals, and I hope that she'll find a way to get it out to theaters all across the country, and people will be going to it and understanding that all these old decrepit reactors could have the same situation occur, because as they get older and older and get these licenses renewed, we're in deep doo-doo. And the public is being led to believe that we have to rely on them to help mitigate climate change, which is really the worst kind of greenwashing concept that there could be out there. So I'm hoping that this will fight that and help get the truth out. Now, that may not be the focus of her film, but it's certainly going to tie in with where we're being led by the present administration to keep them all and you know, let's hold on to our nuke plants. It's only going to get worse if we keep them all open. I think that will help educate the mainstream public, and that's what we need. We can't just go and see a film and it's never heard of again. So I'm rooting for her. I think it will get mass released. I think she has a film that is definitely worthy of being released as a regular film. Just mass release, of, as they call mass releases. That's what I pray for this film. I really do, because it's a powerful tool to educate the public. That's what she has. And she doesn't have anything that feels fanatic or like a conspiracy theory, which is what people, they think that's what we do. We're just like making a big thing up. And that's what you feel when you see this film. You never feel that way.
Radioactive, the women of Three Mile Island, received a standing ovation from the full house at the Dances with Films Festival, and won the Audience Award for Best Documentary Film. We wish Heidi Huttner and all the participants every success, and look forward to talking with the director very soon for this program. If you want to follow the progress of the film and find out where it's going to be popping up next, you can do so at the website radioactivethefilm.com. My thanks to Priscilla Starr, and for Joe DeMare for being where I couldn't be and providing these insights and interviews. And on the website, we will link to Joe DeMare's program, A Green Future. It will be at nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, number 598.
Activists, shout out.
Man, when it rains, it pours. This Friday, December 9, I will be moderating a panel discussion on the film Power Struggle. This is Robbie Lepser's film from 2019, which portrays the heated political battle to shut down the Vermont Yankee aging, problem-plagued nuclear power plant in the state of Vermont. This is in observance of the International Anti-Corruption Day and is being presented by the Museum of Political Corruption. I never knew that existed until they asked. You can register to receive a one-time exclusive access to the film and to join the online discussion on Friday, December 9 at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Guests will include director Robbie Lepser, Tony Klein, who is a retired Vermont state representative who led the fight in the Vermont legislature against Vermont Yankee, Linda Pence Gunter, who is editor, writer, and curator at Beyond Nuclear International, as well as the author of our regular Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Stories, and myself, talking about the media's part in all of this. We'll have a link up for you to register on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 598. The Union of Concerned Scientists invites you to a virtual discussion next week on the risks and consequences of nuclear escalation in Russia's war on Ukraine. The date is Tuesday, December 13th, and it will be 1 hour from 8 till 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time in the United States. The virtual discussion will feature Aaron McDonald, who's an analyst on global security programs for the Union of Concerned Scientists, and Jasmine Owens, Associate Director, Nuclear Weapons Abolition Program, Physicians for Social Responsibility. You can register now and submit a question to the speakers in advance. We'll have the link on the website. And to help make nuclear information more understandable, there is now a comic book, a graphic report on nuclear waste in Canada. Among the many talking points, the focus is on the specific presumed advantages of nuclear technology, but without indicating how to safely store the waste produced, the radioactive dangerous waste produced, for the next 100,000 years. We'll have a link to it up on the website with all the others. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, December 6, 2022. Material for this week's show has been researched and compiled from nuclear-news.net, deunrenard.wordpress.com, beyondnuclear.org, nears.org, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICANW.org, the International Atomic Energy Agency, Ed Lyman of the Union of Concerned Scientists, Dr. Paul Dorfman, pravda.com, thebulletin.org, chemistryworld.com, climatecrocs.com, yahoo.com, npr.com, pontiactribune.com, newyorktimes.com, scientificamerican.com, theguardian.com, tokyo-np.co.jp, rnz.co.nz, minpo.jp, japantimes.co.jp, express.co.uk, ukrainetoday.org, bloomberg.com, thetimes.co.uk, laka.org, and the captured and compromised by the industry they're supposed to be regulating, Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Our thanks to Linda Pence Gunter of Beyond Nuclear for her Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story. And again, thanks to Joe DeMare for doing the interviews on site at Radioactive, the Women of Three Mile Island. Joe's show is A Green Future. It's a live radio show that then gets rebroadcast as a podcast and on YouTube. And you can link to it all on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 598. Now, if you want to make certain you don't miss a single episode of Nuclear Hot Seat, you can get it delivered via email every week. Just sign up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com. Scroll down for the yellow box, put in your first name and email address. Every week, you'll get a link to the episode and a short description of the show's content. Or, if you do podcasts a lot, go to your favorite podcast channel, enter Nuclear Hot Seat, we will pop up, and you can follow us that way as well. Now, this is at times a participatory democracy. So if you, yes you, know of a story in your area, and you've got a lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send it in an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, we're now a 501c3 nonprofit, so if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. Anything you can do, we appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2022, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, the website, and heck, you can even mention me. This is Libby Halevi, producer and host of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, every nuclear reactor is a dirty bomb on the ground. Yeah, that's right, even the one in your neighborhood. That's it. This has been your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.